Asia Pacific Report on Sabahul Muslim with Sanusha Naidu.
Sanusha, very good morning to you. Welcome once again.
Good morning and thank you. Hope you're well.
I'm very good. And yourself?
Not bad, not bad.
China is a key electoral issue in the upcoming Australian elections.
Absolutely. So Australia is going into elections, I think it's later this week. I think the date is the 21st of May. And the China factor has featured quite prominently in election issues, foreign policy issues, and of course between the two parties, the current party in power and the Labour Party that's the opponent. And what's very interesting about the China factor in the elections is that if we look at the Morrison government, it's been a very anti-Chinese government. It's been very aggressive towards China's stance in the South China Sea. It's been aggressive around China's positioning in global politics. It's constantly raised the red flag about China. Before the lockdown has happened, it wanted China to come out and open up the space and take responsibility for the COVID-19 pandemic, the fact that it started in Wuhan. It was speculated that China needed to show some kind of remorse and compensation. But what's interesting about this factor in the election in Australia is that their opinion polls seem to suggest that amongst Chinese-born descendants or those of Chinese heritage, there's a drop in public opinion. There's a drop in perception from about 28% to about 14% based on how this issue around China is being rallied around as a key electoral issue for both sides. At the same time, I think general populist perception in China suggests that, from the Pew report, suggests that there's about a high as a 75-78% kind of, I wouldn't say anti-Chinese pushback, but a kind of perception that China raises a lot of red flags for Australia. Not necessarily only domestically, but I think also in terms of China, of Australia's regional neighborhood. And of course, there's the whole question of the Solomon Islands issue, where there's a sense that in the Pacific, and in particular in the Solomon Islands, China is becoming a much more explicit actor. And there's a sense by Canberra that there needs to be a pushback there. So very, very interesting that China becomes a key driver for this election. But it's a question of degrees in which it will play a role in influencing and shaping the electoral behavior of the voters when they go to the polls later in the week.
Now, the U.S. seeks to wean India from Russia weapons with arms aid package.
Yeah, this is a fascinating story. India has been quite an interesting actor in the South Asian context. It's also a member of the Quad. Later this week, we'll see President Biden visiting South Korea and having meetings with Quad members. It's an informal quadrilateral engagement. It's Australia, it's Japan, South Korea, and the U.S. But I think since the Russian-Ukraine crisis, there's been a sense that New Delhi has not come out and supported the West in its sanctions, in its denouncement and isolation of Russia. And partly because Russia is seen as a key economic actor for New Delhi, and also in terms of the fact that New Delhi buys a predominant portion of its oil from Moscow. So I think at the end of the day, what's quite interesting about this is that whilst the Modi government was seen as a government that could have been a reliable, if not viable, ally for the West in this whole question around Russia, Ukraine, and the voting patterns in the UN Security Council, especially in the UN General Assembly, I think the idea is, how do you get New Delhi to become much more aligned to the West and aligned to the way in which the G7 has also been quite critical of Russia and trying to go on this quite an offensive strategy in getting countries to, for a lack of a better way to put it, switch sides. And I think this whole defense deal that we're seeing Biden talk about and the U.S. Congress speak about in terms of how to up the ante on this is just one section of the diplomacy, but it's also going to cost a lot of money in terms of what does this mean for the U.S. in terms of the New Delhi buying defense armaments from Russia, because it comes with quite a hefty price tag. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to create a kind of overnight shift towards Washington or towards the G7. India has been invited to attend the G7 meeting in Germany. The other thing to bear in mind as well is that this kind of deal reminisces of the civilian nuclear deal under the Bush Jr. administration, where India had been given a kind of backdoor entrance to become a kind of de facto nuclear power through the civilian nuclear deal that was negotiated. And so this again kind of sees India in that space, in that geostrategic space. But then, of course, as certain analysts and certain commentators have mentioned, the big challenge, I think, for Washington here is that how does it decide who actually doesn't get sanctioned for buying, whether it's the S-400 missile defense system from Russia, because Turkey was clearly sanctioned on that because it purchased that kind of missile defense system. And, of course, that meant ties with Washington became much more fragile. But, of course, at the end of the day, to try and get the Modi government to move to the U.S. as an alternative and completely away from Russia is going to be quite an expensive package and an expensive deal. And, of course, it's not necessarily going to be a done deal. So I think this is something that we have to keep as a watching brief.
Finally, then, will Kim Jong-un look to China to battle North Korea's explosive COVID-19 spread?
Well, this story is quite fascinating in the sense that up until now, North Korea didn't have any COVID-19 infection until we saw an explosive spread emerge, where we even saw the North Korean leader wearing a mask, and we saw that there were family members that were basically talking about being in isolation. But of course, you know, in a population of about 26 million people, it's been reported that 1.48 million people have had fever. Now, they're not calling it COVID-19. They're calling it fever cases. So it's a very interesting play on what's going on. And of course, there were 50 linked by deaths to the virus, according to state media. But I think the problem is that the propaganda around this whole issue of COVID-19 and whether or not North Korea was COVID-19 free, etc., is now beginning to unravel itself. And so the challenge is, will they accept support from South Korea, which also said that they would come in and provide some kind of health diplomacy and support to the country. But at the same time, the question is, will they be looking to China to do this? Because China is a closer ally to the North Korean authorities. So I think at the end of the day, it's a big issue for North Korea. I think the leader of North Korea has become quite aggressive towards his officials, who he feels should take more responsibility for the spread of the virus. But at the same time, there's going to be questions around what kind of national lockdown will emerge. And there was an event, a military event that happened not about, I think, two months ago, which probably seems to be the super spreader event for the infection rise. So I think at the end of the day, the questions around quarantine, the questions around vaccinations, the question around non-medical intervention protocols and support, would China be the country that would try and provide that support? Because China is also going through its own Omicron moment, and in terms of virus infections and increasing transmission rates, etc. So they just in certain parts of China, I think around Shanghai, they're coming out of a serious lockdown. And of course, North Korea is on the border of China, and China doesn't want to see that vulnerability increase in terms of more spread and more increases of infection.
All right, Sarusha, as always, thanks for the update. We'll talk again next week.
Pleasure. Have a great week. Cheers.